A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
You join us in leafy London on a lovely sunny day, 24 hours before the championships at Wimbledon begin, and myself, David Law, sitting alongside Matt Roberts in Catherine Whittaker's garden. Hello, Catherine.
Which all the listeners will now know of it is that it's right underneath the Heathrow flight path.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
Other than that, it's delightful.
Yeah, we're brought to you in association with The Telegraph. We've already devoured Catherine's selection of nibbles that she's brought out for us here. What a great host you are.
Some with more style than others.
Yeah. Yes, Matt did have a moment.
I'm never going to live this down, am I?
He just casually reached across the table as if it was the most natural thing in the world, grabbed a chunk of strawberry and dipped it into avocado hummus.
That's what students do. Or did.
And I intervened before it reached his mouth just to check that he knew what he was doing. So there was a chance to back out and he proceeded.
Do you want to explain yourself?
I mean, I haven't done it again. it was a one-off, both taste-wise, and I saw the look of horror that came across Catherine's face.
But you knew what you were doing, right?
I was on automatic pilot. Mm. The strawberries are at a distance and the hummus is near, and it was just on the way home back to my mouth and I just dipped it in.
Yeah, so this is what the people want. They want snack based chat, and there you are, folks. Don't mix strawberries with avocado hummus. So what have we got to talk about? Well, only one of the four biggest tournaments in the world, arguably the biggest. I've been there for the first time in 2019 today, and had a little chat on BBC 5 Live with Annabel Croft on the edge of court number one, the one with the brand spanking new big roof
that's not going to get used.
It's not going to get used the whole week ahead, at least. And if it does get used, they can do it in 6.5 minutes, apparently.
Wow!
From button pressing, I tried to have a go, but they.
But then it's the acclimatization system that takes the time, isn't it?
Oh.
I don't know.
Yeah, I always thought Centre Court was about 10 minutes to close, but it's always a much longer delay, isn't it? Because they have to get the
Just get the aircon
atmosphere
on.
Right.
So while I was out there, the young qualifier, Coco Gauff, who's 15 years of age and plays 39-year-old Venus Williams. So we very nearly had a 40-15 contest. Instead, it's 39-15. And they're playing on court number one tomorrow. And, yeah, she basically came out to have a look at what the court's like because, I mean, it must be pretty daunting standing there today. It was utterly deserted. There must have been 20 people out there in the stands, you know, no more. And it was so serene, so quiet. And she just wandered out with a couple of people, had a look around, and then wandered off again. Big day for her coming up.
I love that. It's really humanising, isn't it? Especially for somebody that, I mean, she's only 15 still, but I've known about Coco Gauff for a couple of years now, which is absurd, really. And for somebody that's been touted and tipped for so long already, you can sort of imagine them just taking the experience like she's going to have tomorrow, maybe too much in stride, sort of thinking, oh yeah, this is the sort of moment that I've known has been coming to me for a while now. Everyone's been telling me I'm going to have this moment, and so it's going to happen. Yeah, shrug. So I like the thought of her going out and trying to get a taste of it and acclimatise and adjust and
visualize.
Really consider the magnitude. I mean, she might not have been doing any of that. She might have just needed somewhere to have a sit down. But I'll assume that that's what she was doing, and I, I like it.
Yeah, she was out there, and she will be third on court number one tomorrow. So, you know, that's a big time of the day, isn't it, as well? You've had a couple of matches. It's the tea time audience sort of thing. It's going to be all eyes on that match. It's a huge occasion. She was saying that the reason she plays the sport is because of Serena and Venus Williams. They are the inspiration.
Including Serena's eyes on that match, Matt.
Yeah, Serena said, I think I might watch that, even though I get really nervous when I watch Venus play. But it's amazing, like, what Serena and Venus had to go through as young black tennis players. They have just paved the way and fought the fight for people like Coco Gauff, and it's absolutely no wonder that she looks up to the Williams sisters. Incidentally, we know that her first Wimbledon memory is 2011, Coco Gauff. which made me feel old.
What's your first Wimbledon memory?
2004?
When was Venus's...
it's hardly any better, is
Hang
it?
On, when That's... was Venus's last Wimbledon title? When was number five?
I can't remember. She's won seven slams in total.
Yeah, five Wimbledons. Were any of them post 2011?
Don't think so.
No.
So she actually doesn't remember Venus winning a Wimbledon.
No. Yeah. I think it's 2009. I think her last one. Something like that. So his first Wimbledon memory is when Federer beat Roddick in the final.
Do you not remember 2001?
No. Goodness. I mean, I was only five.
Oh. What's your first Wimbledon memory?
I remember watching... being forced to watch, actually, in the days before I liked tennis, when my family loved tennis and I was the dissenter. I remember sitting down to watch Henman versus Forget, second or third round or something. I mean, it would have been like 91, 92. I feel like it might have been... No, I'm getting a head shake here.
Henman, no. That's not right.
After that?
You mean Bates Forget?
Bates Forget, that's what I mean.
Yeah, 1992.
It was that memorable.
Sorry, it was a long time ago, David. 92?
Yes.
There we go.
Yeah, they played each other in the fourth round, and Jeremy Bates was leading the charge, trying to get to the quarterfinals. Had match point.
We had a French au pair at the time, so it was all very tense in our living room. So I recall the tension.
Anglo-Franco relations.
Yeah. I was not interested at all. Yeah. I was along for the ride.
That was my 11th memory of Wimbledon, years-wise. My first memory was 1981. Don't look at me like that. Bjorn Borg against John McEnroe in the final is my first memory. So, yeah.
So you don't quite remember the famous tiebreak?
No, I don't. I'd been told stories of it by my dad.
Apparently there's an event somewhere in London where there's like an immersive experience where you can watch that final. I mean, I keep being offered free tickets to it, so it doesn't sound like it's selling brilliantly. But
where are my free tickets?
You have to dress up, don't you, as though you're in the 80s.
What, you're saying it's that, like, Catherine said no to this?
It's like Secret of Cinema, but for tennis nerds.
Oh, I like the sound of it. Right, so yeah, we saw Coco Gauff today, and she's playing Venus Williams tomorrow. We have had the draws. We also have Matt Roberts here on his ranking for the first time at Wimbledon. He's actually been accredited, and he has his own desk, I noticed today. I went in and found him.
I was looking at Jan Lennard Struff stats, and then David came along and suddenly was taking photos of me.
He's a dangerous floater, isn't he?
What, David Law? I generally Struff.
Yeah, but apparently he's got this really bad recording on grass.
Why is that? Why have some people who you're absolutely sure are going to be amazing on grass have gotten not very good records, like Karolina Pliskova at Wimbledon?
The only thing I can really think is that they just don't play on it enough. And a lot of people need reps, right? And Struff has been a late bloomer, you know, career-wise. You feel like he needs time to figure things out, perhaps. And yeah, he's got like a record like 1-10 in Halle. And
really?
Yeah, and I think he's like reached one third round at Wimbledon, which was last year. So perhaps he's finding his feet. But yeah, I'd have thought he should be more dangerous than his record suggests.
Glad he looked this up now.
Is he lurking in anybody significant section?
There must
have been a reason why you were looking him up.
Well, just interested.
It was Struff. Yeah, it was. I was waiting for David, and I thought, let's look up Struff. He's in the Nishikori. He's in the Nishikori section.
No irony whatsoever. I was waiting for David, so I thought I'd just look up Struff. That's like Andy Murray plucking Sheng Shalken out of absolutely nowhere.
He's in the Nishikori section.
Right.
So opportunity knocks.
Opportunity knocks to take Nishikori to five sets, get beaten, but wipe Nishikori out for his next match.
Except we've got a new Nishikori tactic.
Underarm serve, which...
We're waiting.
We're waiting for credit. Yeah. Wimbledon wrote a whole article about it today, about Nishikori following the footsteps of Michael Chang, which...
I'm serious about this. We are 100% responsible for this.
Maybe 100% is pushing it.
No,
ever so slightly.
Catherine got the scoop.
I don't think it would have occurred to him. I saw his face. We need to dig up that interview that probably never saw the light of day anywhere. But I was there and I remember it. I saw his face when I said, "Oh, how about a sneaky underarm serve?" And that was the first time he had thought of it.
But it wouldn't have
in that moment. Was when the seed was planted.
It wouldn't have occurred to us without Michael Chang, would it? Or Nick Kyrgios.
But Michael Chang is really reticent to talk about the underarm serve. Whenever you ask him about it, and he was asked about it a lot at the French Open, he always says, "Oh, well, I did it because I was cramping." He never has a sort of twinkle in his eye and goes, "Yeah, you know, I'm pleased to see it coming." He always makes the point that I did it because I had no other choice. I can't imagine him sitting Nishikori down and going, "This is a great tactic, mate."
Nishikori spoke about it in tactical depth. Like, if they're standing way behind the baseline, I might throw it in, but he doesn't think that might happen on grass.
He's thought about nothing else since the French Open, Matt.
Well, because he did one at Hurlingham. This is where this is all picked, you know, it's all got interesting again, because he actually did one. We spent the whole French Open pleading for him to do it, and he didn't, and he threw it in the exhibition where not many people were watching, yet clipped, and he won the point.
Yeah, 100% success rate.
So, Struff, that's what you got coming.
And, well, second round for Struff is segue Taylor Fritz.
Who, incidentally, champion. Is looking like a player. And I have you know, after he won the Eastbourne title, I messaged Paul Annacone, his coach.
Ooh.
Yeah, who Catherine's just doing the old name dropping sign there, correctly, which because I'm interested by Fritz in that. To me, it feels like he's taken his time to actually do anything of real note. I mean, we first heard of him about when he was about 18. And I remember on the Champions Tour, we had him at one of the tournaments that Pete Sampras was at on the Champions Tour. It might have been Del Rey or somewhere like that, where they've got both types of event. And Sampras was saying, "Taylor Fritz hits a really big ball. I'm impressed with him." And... we kind of waited, didn't we? And not much happened, it seemed.
He married and became a father at 18, didn't he? Or maybe just 19. So I think he's had a lot going on in his very young life. And his family travel on tour with him very much. You know, that's an immense distraction. I mean, I know people are doing it, but to try and do that at such a tender stage of your career when... you're not remotely established, you're trying to transition from juniors, is a heck of an ask. And I think he has physically struggled to fill out a bit, hasn't he? He does still look like a junior. I mean, if you stood him, not quite a junior, but still looks like someone that's transitioning. If you stood him next to Tsitsipas, I think they would look like two different specimens.
It's a bit like Zverev, isn't it? Where you're thinking...
The newborn Borg.
Yeah, that's what the back page said. The newborn Bjorn Borg is Alexander Zverev. Not what the article said, written very well, nicely by Mike Dixon, I should add, but the headline, slightly misrepresentative. Anyway, Taylor Fritz says, Paul Annacone, he's only 21, so I think his progress is pretty rapid, distorted a bit because of a Memphis final at 18. He says, I believe that was a blessing and a curse. In any case, he's getting better, understanding his game better, and how to make players uncomfortable with his strengths. He's got very big power and one of the best two-handers on the tour already. His ability to compete unconditionally and his enjoyment of competition will push him far. He has no fear of losing or winning, which are very promising traits. And, I mean, really, Paul Annacone is a process guy. He doesn't talk about results. He's not a sort of self-promoter in that way. He just wants to see raw materials being put together, a base being put together so that a player can compete at a high level every time. Whether he wins or not, he wants to see that output being the same.
Because that Memphis final Fritz reached was only his second ATP tournament, and he reached the final. So he was like, suddenly so much was expected from him. And then this Eastbourne final was the first final he'd reached since then. So he'd had that huge three or four year gap. But I read an interview with Fritz at the start of the year with Steve Flink that he did.
Yeah, I saw that.
And he was really ambitious and like saying, I think I can finish in the top 20 easily this year. Me and Francis. I like that attitude. He really does think that he's going places. And I didn't necessarily see top 20 maybe for him this year, but he had quite a good clay court season.
Well, he's what, 42 now?
Yeah.
Plus whatever he gets from Eastbourne. He's a couple of good slams away, isn't
from
he?
That.
I liked
that.
His commitment to the clay court season. Yeah. I think he was the only American that played in Monte Carlo. He beat Joe Wilfred, Songa, I think, retired. But he had a few results on the clay that made me raise my eyebrow just a little bit.
It's one of those ones where he played Federer in Melbourne, didn't he, and didn't get close. And he played Djokovic, I think, on clay and didn't really get close. And that's so easy to judge people based on those results, but they're not the matches he needs to be winning if he's going to get in the top 20.
He needs to be beating Jan and Struff.
Yeah, and winning Eastbourne and things like that.
Mm. And actually, he said about that Federer match at the Australian Open, he was really disappointed with his performance. He lost 6-2, 7-5, 6-2, and he just felt he didn't do what he's capable of doing. He said, I left him with way too many balls to attack with. Mm. And he said he takes it so early, you realise what you're up against, that if you fall short at all, he's on you. But what that article said, because I read that earlier today, it was pointing out that he then went straight on to a challenger, won a match, something like 4-6, 7-6, 7-6 in the first round, then won the event. You know, it was one of those that he fought through, and you just wonder whether that's kind of this could be the moment. This could be his launch pad now. I mean, 21, it feels like he should be 23.
Yeah.
Because he's been around for a while. But it's a really good... I mean, it's Kyle Edmund in the semis, Sam Querrey in the final. And in the first round, he's got Thomas Burdick at Wimbledon.
I would pick Federer today, I believe.
I would take Fritz to win that. What do you think?
Same.
Yeah.
There's nothing really to go on with Burdick. No form or anything.
I mean, he was at Queen's, wasn't he? Because he was desperately hoping to get into qualies. He was waiting on whether Nicholas Jarry got an extra win in Stuttgart, because if he did, it would mean he'd had to have pulled out of Queen's qualies. So the sight of Thomas Burdick anxiously waiting around Queen's, you know, Wimbledon finest, to find out if he's going to get into the qualifying draw was... It was a similar feeling to seeing Grigor Dimitrov scheduled on court 15 tomorrow.
Oh dear, that hurt, didn't it?
Yeah.
Doesn't feel right. Even though that's clearly a good court, it's got a lot of good players on it, but it still, you know.
Yeah, I mean, what does he think about that? He's probably somewhere being as jolly as anything, going, oh yeah, my shoulder hurts a bit, but I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be great. Oh, I've lost in the first round.
He's not the sort of fella who would complain about it.
No.
And actually... Honestly, he's got nothing to complain about.
No,
I don't.
It's the right assignment,
but it's what that says.
Mm. So we've had the draw. We'll go on to that in a minute. But the press conference day was yesterday, Matt. Who struck you coming through? What struck you?
Well, I think Nadal was interesting, because there's been this whole debate about the seeding for Nadal, which seems to have become a debate again this year, even though it's been a thing for ages now, this seeding formula. I think it's just because it's affected Nadal and Federer, and it's affected them in a unique way.
And one of them has spoken out.
And spoken out about it. Because, I mean, last year, Federer was seeded above Nadal, but it was because they switched one and two, which essentially doesn't really matter in the draw. But I think at the heart of that debate is whether the seeding formula is still necessary. Is grass still such a distinctive surface? I mean, Nadal's argument is that by having that formula, it just devalues ranking, and you know, the fact that the ATP...
And he's really into rankings.
He is into rankings.
And the race.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I don't really have a strong opinion on it. I don't... Like, we have the seeding formula, fine. I don't care about it that much, really. But I just think it's interesting how Nadal has got so worked up about it. Like, does he think he's got a really... like good chance of winning Wimbledon. Is it a good sign that he's really annoyed
Isn't it just, to his mind, not fair? The fact that the surface he's really good on, you don't have any help, and the surface that Federer's really good on, he gets help.
But I mean, there's three Masters events on clay. Like you've...
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought about the seeding formula and the injustice, the potential injustice therein for years. But then. I saw what happened this year and I just suddenly thought, oh, hang on, that doesn't feel quite right. I didn't have an opinion, certainly didn't have a negative opinion of the seeding formula, but I don't think it feels quite right what happened. Nadal being bumped for Federer, regardless of the fact that I probably would put Federer just ahead of Nadal in my favourites list, but...
Do you know, they used to do it.
Not enough to rectify the rankings.
Back before you were born, when I was still watching tennis, Matt and Catherine, they used to literally have a committee that would look at the rankings and then just move people about a bit, depending on how they thought, you know, who had the better record.
Just slide Tim Henman up a bit.
I mean, at least now it is a formula. It is very transparent. Everybody knows what it is. I say that. I don't really know what it is. But there is a formula. They apply it and you end up with what you get. I personally don't like the fact that the same isn't applied to the women's rankings at all, and from what I understand, that's because the WTA doesn't want it and have railed against that.
And that was Nadal's argument, yeah. Was it? He called upon the ATP, said we as the ATP need to wield our power here and say this isn't right. We're
giving 2,000 points to this event. The ATP should have the leverage.
It was very much a sort of protective kind of, we are giving points to this. You are not bigger than our tour, kind of. It was quite sort of posturing talk.
Doesn't feel quite right to me, I must say, overall. It should all be the same.
You just knew that the most dangerous of all the floaters was going to come out in a dull section after that seeding hoo-ha.
Well, let's get on to his draw quickly, because we'll talk about press conferences again in a minute. But from what I understand, he has... a horror draw. I mean, it would come out like that, wouldn't it?
He'd certainly swap his draw with Federer's, wouldn't he, Matt?
He would. I don't know if it's quite as dangerous as some people are making out. I mean, it really all depends which Kyrgios shows up. Like,
if a Kyrgios shows up.
If he's not beaten by Jordan Thompson in the first round.
I feel like we've had situations before where Kyrgios was due to play a top player and not really shown up in the match before, and we've not had that match that we've all been hoping for.
That happens every slam.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's Sagita in the first round, and then Thompson or Kyrgios, and then Shapovalov or Songa, and then maybe Cilic in the fourth round. But, I mean, a lot of those players are not in great form.
None of those particularly worry me for Nadal other than Kyrgios.
I agree.
Yeah, I wouldn't back Shapovalov or Songa to beat Nadal.
No.
The form that they're in at the moment, I think Cilic, if he were to play really well, could. But he's had a rough time recently. He beat him in Hurlingham, I think it was in the week. I mean, how much you can read into that, I don't know.
I think the interesting thing about Nadal is, what do you give more weight to? Sort of 5 years of not doing a lot at Wimbledon, 2012 onwards, or last year where he looked really good at Wimbledon?
I'd go with last year as well.
Yeah,
you know, but for a roof related decision, he could very easily have been in that final.
Yeah. Sure,
would have most likely won that final. We'll never know, but yeah, I'd agree, last year for sure. I mean,
But it's in the back of my mind, though, all those years where he didn't quite perform at Wimbledon.
I worry about him more in the early rounds, which is why I'm worried for him that he's potentially got Kyrgios in round two. That is a big worry.
If he plays Kyrgios, it's the an impossibility to predict that with confidence, isn't it? Because if Kyrgios from Acapulco turns up when he was just loving it and driving Nadal,
but he's always
crazy,
loving it against the top players. He would be loving it on centre court at Wimbledon against Nadal.
Well, he should do.
He just might not love it in round one against Jordan Thompson on court 15 or wherever they put that. And it will be interesting to see where they put that, because that's two unseeded players against one another. But yeah, he will show up for that match if he makes it there.
In the men's draw, how big is the mix? How many players, how many ingredients are in the mix?
Well, I've got an unanswered text on my phone from a friend who likes tennis but is only a casual observer, and it just says, is Stefanos Tsitsipas in the mix for Wimbledon? And I have not replied because I don't know what to say.
I think if you're defining the mix as players you would not be surprised if they won the event, the mix is three. And it's Djokovic, Federer and Nadal. I would be surprised if Tsitsipas won Wimbledon.
Yeah, he's got you there, David.
No, he hasn't.
You would be... There are other players that you wouldn't be surprised to see win this Wimbledon on the men's side.
Is the mix not players I think can win Wimbledon in 2019?
No. We've been over this. No. Anyone can win Wimbledon. Can is a redundant turn of phrase. I can win Wimbledon if, you know,
somebody
the other 128 people pull out and I get offered some kind of honorary wild card. Do you know what I mean? Like, let's not get into the multiverse here.
But come on.
No, we're not getting into can, David.
Well, all right. Well, that I think he has a good chance of winning.
Would you be surprised? Because this is how we decided to define it.
No.
Okay.
I think Tsitsipas is in the mix.
So we're sticking with the definition.
It's four players.
So anyone else would surprise you.
You'd be less surprised by Tsitsipas than by Wawrinka.
I'd be more surprised by Wawrinka, certainly.
Okay.
No question.
Yeah, I would be as well.
I'd be more surprised about all the other 125 players or whatever it is in the draw than Tsitsipas.
I mean, I agree that Tsitsipas is the troublemaker here in terms of the definition of the mix, because it feels like he should be in the mix, and yet I would be surprised if he won Wimbledon this year.
Is Felix Auger-Aliassime in the mix?
I wouldn't be, you know...
With his record over Tsitsipas.
Apparently he was the fifth favourite with some of the bookies. He's never won a Grand Slam match. But
We're both in the mix.
It does feel like there are fewer threats this year. I feel like last year we were talking about, well, everyone was picking up Cilic, weren't they? And Anderson, people, was in good form and obviously got to the final. But then they're not really there this year.
No.
Yeah, that's true. The best of the rest. I mean, Dimitrov was being talked about last year, maybe not as a title contender, other than by the ever hopeful. but he was at least in the conversation. He's not even in the conversation this year. Amazingly, the mix has narrowed. It's become less complex, less rich.
Just before we go, are you having this beer or not?
It's for you.
Oh, thanks. Okay, so...
and Wimbledon is where it's been the toughest to break through the big four. I mean, they've won all of them going back to 2003. Federer, Nadal, Djokovic and Murray. I mean, and Federer and Nadal...
They've won all the Wimbledons.
Going back to 2003. Federer won Wimbledon in 2003.
Before Matt's memory began.
Yeah. So I'd be really surprised
if
someone
else won.
You have
never seen anyone win Wimbledon that's not in the big four.
Oh my
God. Yeah.
That's unbelievable. What? Wow. So your mix is... No wonder your mix is three.
Well, quite, yeah.
The other bloke's not even playing. And, but incidentally, in the mix for the doubles, Andy Murray and partner. That's it. That's his mix.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, I have seen other people win the doubles.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
What is the mix looking like for the women's straw then? How many is in that?
I can't give you a number, but it's a lot more than three.
I think it's perhaps fewer than in Paris.
Who's the favourite?
I think Barty's the favourite. I know she's got a horrible draw.
Tell us about her draw, Matt.
Barty doesn't think she's the favourite, but she wouldn't, would she? So Barty has Zheng Sai Sai in the first round, then faces the winner of Kuznetsova van Oytvank.
Just a casual twice Grand Slam champion in the second round there?
Then,
or a grass court specialist?
Then probably Garbiñe Muguruza in round three.
Wimbledon champion?
And then Bencic in round four, and then Serena or Kerber to reach the semi-finals.
Thing is, though, I would back her, albeit marginally in some, in all of those matches. And I think if you come through a draw like that, it hardens you. So, yeah, I still have Barty as a favourite. Pick me another individual as a favourite. I know lots of people are saying Pliskova, and she won Eastbourne, and that's great. But she won Rome, and she...
And she won Brisbane And she won Brisbane before the Australian Open.
And it just doesn't...
It's the
I'm on fool me sort of seven times with Pliskova or something. It's not even fool me twice.
I would have said Barty on all other things being equal as a draw. I just don't think that is all other things being equal. I think there's a cumulative effect there. That
who do you think's coming through that section then?
Well, I haven't done my predictions yet, but I will probably still end up going for Serena Williams.
I think I'm going to be picking Serena to win the title.
I think I might be as well.
Just... She was in
I can't argue with that. Serena Williams at Wimbledon, Williams. Isn't it? But, you know, I've not seen her play fit for months.
No, that's the
months.
Big thing.
I mean, I know they're talking it up, aren't they? Both she and Patrick Mouratoglou
talking it up?
He has been... I can't escape him. I'm not even at Wimbledon. I can't escape him. But they are talking up the state of her knee, aren't they?
Well, she stayed on in Paris and had some treatment there. And she says her knee is fine. And if we believe her, I keep thinking she's going to break the record. She's going to get the record. So I have to start predicting her to win some slams. And last year she reached the Wimbledon final barely getting out of about second or third gear, really. And it just what she's capable of doing with her serve and her sort of first strike tennis on grass. I don't think she needs, and the movement doesn't have to be quite as precise maybe as it has to be on the clay.
What's her draw like, Matt?
Horrible.
I think she can ease into it. I'm
looking forward to you pronouncing this Italian's name.
Oh gosh, yeah. Giulia Gatto.
Oh, the paper's gone flying.
It's gone flying. Giulia Gatto Monticone.
Yeah.
And then Kaya Juvan or Kristina Pliskova. And then Julia Gerges, which would be a repeat of last year's semi final. And then Kerber round four.
Mm. Kerber looked good in Eastbourne, didn't she? Lost out to Pliskova in the end, but I was impressed with her overall. Yeah, I mean, I haven't done my predictions yet, and the thought of not predicting Serena to win it also feels silly.
I'm less convinced by Barty now that she's won the French Open. A, because now I've got what I wanted. She's won a slam this year. I don't have to go out on a limb anymore. But I just feel... We saw with Halep what that does to players.
Yeah, but she backed it up by winning Birmingham.
Yeah, she did, but she's world number one.
But if she wins Wimbledon, she'd be on a 19-match winning streak. I mean, it feels like... I mean, okay, she can do it, but it feels like...
I mean, we haven't seen dominance even close to that from anybody in women's tennis for years. Not even since Serena last dominated like that. Since the 2015 year, probably.
There was a bit of Muguruza, and obviously there was Osaka winning two slams in a row. But if Barty were to win this,
there were surprise losses in the intervening period.
She was in a good mood, like. The very fact that she did press was interesting because she's not done a press conference before the Australian Open and she didn't do one before Roland Garros. And she's not, given that she's not in the top eight, she's not obliged to do it. But she did do it, which would be a good sign.
Do you think she did that in order to put a public message out there and mount the pressure on Andy Murray to pick her as his mixed doubles partner?
No, I don't. But I'd find it very interesting that neither one of them are backing away from this idea. It's going to happen.
She was having great fun just stirring things.
It's going to happen, folks.
I think the only stumbling block is her commitment. I think he wants to win the thing. He's not messing around. He doesn't want to hit in a giggle. I think he wants assurances that no matter how far she gets in the singles, no matter if she, you know, feels a twinge in her knee or whatever, she ain't pulling out of that mixed doubles halfway through the tournament. I think that's the only potential stumbling block, because the absolute commitment to it.
These things can get very uncomfortable. I was at Wimbledon working in the communications department in 1999 when John McEnroe played with Steffi Graf in the mixed doubles. And I spent and you have not seen a more excited player than John McEnroe was at that week. Obviously being able to come out of retirement, he's 40 something, and Steffi Graf, who had just won the French Open singles title, comes in and they do this euphoric press conference together, and John is like a little kid, you know, he's so pumped up. They win their first match and it's just all high fives and fist bumps and hugs and happiness. And then she started making progress in the singles draw and pulled out. And he has never forgiven her. He has never forgiven her. And he's every time you speak to him about it, he just brings this up. She threw me under the bus, man. You know, all this stuff. And he couldn't believe it. He could not believe that she pulled out on him. Not that I'm saying Andy Murray will be quite so furious at Serena if that happens.
Don't he'd be impressed? Well, don't think he'd hold back.
Put it this
way. He might not hold a grudge for quite so long.
He's making his argument sharpish, isn't he? Just to make sure that everybody knows where everybody stands.
But assuming that element can be resolved, she's saying she's up for it. You don't turn that down, do you?
No.
You're not going to find anyone better. You could say for her maybe it's not the best thing, but she usually plays women's doubles and singles at Wimbledon. She's not playing women's doubles with Venus this year.
I think that's big. Therefore, that's a big factor in her ability to be able to do this.
Freeze up her schedule.
And actually, I would suggest that she needs matches. She needs time on a court, so this is more time on a court.
Yeah, she doesn't think that. She was asked about why she didn't play a warm-up event, and she just said, I know how to play tennis. Which is such a brilliant answer.
Did she actually say that?
Yes, I know how to play tennis.
Oh, right. She's going to win Wimbledon, isn't she?
She's in that mood.
Yeah.
Sold. And interesting about Pliskova, something I read in her interview with Courtney Lewin, WTA Insider, about why she doesn't like... Well, she does like grass, but why she... perhaps hasn't had the results. Apparently, she really doesn't like the ball being so low and having to get down to it. And it struck me when I read that, I thought, oh yeah, she is really upright when she plays.
That makes no sense to me, though. She hits a flat ball. She should be able to feed off that and hit it even harder, I think.
But to get down to it in the first place...
is what she doesn't like.
You know, if people slice to her and keep the ball low on her on grass.
It's obviously the case. Her results bear that out. Mm. Her results, given how good she is and what a server she is and what she's done elsewhere, they're appalling at Wimbledon. Mm. She made one quarterfinal, something like
one
that?
One second week. I think it was a fourth round.
I think it was just a fourth round.
And I think, the Eastbourne conditions are very different to the Wimbledon conditions. I mean, Wozniacki's traditionally done well at Eastbourne, but never done anything at Wimbledon.
Give us your stats, Catherine. About
I think it's Matt's stat.
Yeah.
Only.
Of course it is.
But I will happily trot it out. Only one person has ever won Eastbourne. No, I've got it wrong. The look of disappointment that just flashed across Matt's face is just going to haunt me.
It was like a strawberry hummus incident in reverse. Oh.
You wrote the agenda, Catherine. I assumed it was your stat.
I just copied and pasted it from Matt's Twitter.
Okay, Matt, tell us what it is.
The last player to win Eastbourne and then Wimbledon was Jana Novotná, 1998.
A long time ago.
21 years since an Eastbourne champion went on to win.
And they've had some slightly odd champions at Eastbourne, but they've also had a lot of players that you would then expect to do things at Wimbledon.
Okay. Well, I said to you earlier when we were talking about it, I just don't trust her at this tournament. And look, I've felt that about other players at other tournaments, and they've proved me wrong. So, for her sake, I hope she proves me wrong, because I like watching her play, but I still don't. I won't back her.
She's in the mix, absolutely, but there is no way I am putting my already ropey predictions standing on her shoulders.
Okay, well, when we do our predictions, I want us all to count up the number of people we respectively have in the women's title mix.
Okay. Okay. That can be done.
I accept that we haven't quite got there yet.
but Pliskova's in the more open bottom half. I mean, we've mentioned Barty and Serena's draw. That top quarter of the women's draw, I've never seen anything like it, with Grand Slam champions, players who like grass, whereas the bottom half of the draw, I mean, obviously Naomi Osaka is the lead name in that half, but, I mean, she's never really had any results here, but she's lost
good
to,
if she could produce here.
And she lost to Venus in 2017, who went on to reach the final, and Kerber last year, who won it. So it's taken a good player and a good performance to beat her. But really interesting, she plays Putintseva in the first round, who she just lost to in Birmingham. And she lost to her in Birmingham and then didn't do press. For the first time ever, she skipped doing a press conference.
Was she fined?
Yeah, she would have been. Yeah. And she said, the reason I didn't do it was because I couldn't even articulate thoughts to my team about it. So I thought, there's just no point in me going to press conference. I felt really bad about it, but it was such a sort of crushing loss. I had nothing to say. So she skipped it, which is interesting because she normally has such interesting things to say after a match. I'm sure she would have done.
She usually uses press to formulate her thoughts, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Sort of a cathartic experience. Wow.
That's
very interesting.
And she says that she first learnt to play on... Well, she first played on grass when she was 16, 17. It's actually less of a natural surface for her than clay. She grew up playing a bit on green clay. And grass is the surface where she has to learn the most. But it kind of suits her game. The sort of first strike tennis aspect of it anyway. And then she said this other quote. She said she was practising with Madison Keys. And she said, I was practicing with Madison Keys and I was 3-love down in 7 minutes, and I thought, I'm not talented. Madison Keys is talented and I'm a hard worker. And I just thought, what are you talking about? She's so talented, and she's kind of like Madison Keys in many ways. They have similar games, kind of thing. She doesn't see that in herself. Like, I just find her fascinating, Osaka.
It's never boring, is it?
Wow. It's, yeah.
She in the mix?
Osaka?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Keys?
Not sure Madison Keys is.
No,
I mean,
I think she is.
Was she... Lindsay Davenport was speaking at the French Open about how much better clay suits her than grass. She said everybody always expects her to do well on grass, and every time she has these good results on clay, people are like, whoa, hey, how are you so good on clay? And she said actually movement wise she finds clay a lot easier than grass, and although she's got the big serve and the big strikes, she finds movement on grass very difficult. And that loss she suffered to Evgenia Rodina on court 12, or maybe court 3. One of the sort of small show courts last year at Wimbledon that I covered for BBC Radio, that really will live with me because, I mean, Radina was injured, actually. I mean, she was a lame animal.
So how does she lose? Waiting. Does she just miss? Or?
Yeah. She just misfired on pretty much every single rally and just looked so out of place on that court. She just looked so uncomfortable out there.
So
and a part of it was the pressure. It was the mental side of it because at that point, that section of the draw had opened up. They were talking about the winner would play Serena, and that match was sort of already being talked up. And you know, winner becomes favourite for the title, etc., etc. So pressure was a factor, but I can't shake the memory of how uncomfortable she looked.
It has to be said as well, she hasn't produced since she's split with Sasha Badger.
Oh, Osaka.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm starting to hear rumblings about that, people questioning that decision, which annoys me a bit because she never said the decision was necessarily going to be the best thing for her tennis.
Mm.
She said, look, I just had to make this decision for my happiness. I wasn't happy and this was the decision I felt I needed to make. So to suggest that it was a mistake on the basis of her results since the split is a complete misunderstanding, I think, of the situation.
And she only had, what, two or three events on hard court after she split, and then she was onto the clay, which isn't her favourite surface, then the grass. I think she's going to enjoy not being the number one just for a little bit. And she gave that fascinating quote to Simon Briggs in that Telegraph interview where she said, like, in Paris she was kind of acting as the world number one, trying to play the role of world number one, but that's not her. She wasn't being herself. Now she's able to be herself a bit more.
Novak Djokovic seems to be working with Goran Ivanišević, as predicted 2 years ago by Catherine Whittaker on the Tennis Podcast. And we have evidence of this because Matt's listened to it today.
Only ever a matter of time.
Yeah, the day 9, 2017 French Open podcast.
Yeah.
Catherine had spoken to Goran at some sort of Legends Hour or something.
Legends Bun Fight, yeah.
Yeah, and it was just after Djokovic had started working with Agassi, and Goran said to you, well, that's not going to last. And you said, I'm reading between the lines here. We both know Goran quite well, but only tennis journalists to tennis players. But I think Goran thinks I want that job. David goes, ooh, how exciting. And then Catherine says, this is hugely preemptive, but I'm just passing on what he was implying.
I said the words, this is hugely preemptive.
Yeah, two years and a few days.
Exactly. But good work.
He has wanted that job for a long time.
Yeah,
I think he has known or felt like he can make a difference to Djokovic, that he can tap into something, connect with him in a way that his latest few coaches, Marion Vaida aside, obviously haven't been able to do. I think he's felt that for a long time.
He's always bigged him up, hasn't he? He's always leapt to the defence of Djokovic. He's never liked the way people, including us, have talked about Djokovic. He doesn't feel that he's had enough credit over the years, and I know that he feels that if Djokovic plays his best, everybody else can forget about it. It is interesting to see what he brings. I think it is temporary. I don't think it's a long-term thing at this stage, but who knows?
And I think he's got commitments in week two of Wimbledon, I think Goran said.
He's playing the Legends, isn't he?
Mm. He's trying to move some things around or something.
Goran's always plate spinner.
He's always moving stuff.
But, I mean, Djokovic is in a very different place now to where he was in 2017. So, I mean, do you think even before then Goran had his eye on coaching Djokovic?
Before then he has been otherwise employed. I think in 2017 hadn't he just split with Burdick?
Mm.
Goran, I think that's why I was asking him about.
I think probably.
It's the
meanest. I mean, Goran loves coaching. He loves being on tour, doesn't he? He just wants to be on tour forevermore.
You basically need to have coached Milos Raonic, don't you, to have a gig at the top of men's tennis coaching. You've got Goran with Djokovic, Ljubicic with Federer, and Moya with Nadal have all gone via Raonic.
That's a Piatti
as well with Churich.
He's unbelievable, isn't he? What a stat that
is. I wonder with... I mean, before that news which came out today about Goran and Djokovic, I had both Nadal and Federer ahead of Djokovic in my list of favourites for Wimbledon.
Oh.
On the basis that he didn't play Queens and what that tells me about his mentality. He went on holiday, apparently, during Queens, and I just think... I think if he was in the right headspace when Wimbledon and be 100% committed to it in his bones, he would have been playing Queens. He'd have gone, I won Wimbledon last year, I reached the Queens final, why would I change that? Instead, he wanted to go on holiday and get away from tennis. I still think he can win Wimbledon, David. He's in the mix. But I had those two as a favourite just ahead of him. But I do find this interesting. It does make me... If he had turned up to Queens with Goran in his corner, I'd have gone, yeah, man, this is the business now. This is the team that's winning this Wimbledon. I just wonder if it's a tiny bit too late.
What's Goran going to be saying about these seven-hour player council meetings, like the one that Djokovic attended... yesterday?
He's going to be saying that's bullshizzle.
Which Weller Evans has been made the third player board rep, taking the place of Justin Gummelstob. And that meeting and that decision, incidentally, that's only a short term one, because there's re-election next year for all of the board members. But that's been closely followed by four members now of the player council resigning: Jamie Murray, Sergei Stokowski, Danny Valvadu, and Robin Haase.
Because it actually wasn't the council that reached that decision to elect Weller Evans. They were actually deadlocked 5-5, and it had to be the existing two representatives that elected the third representative, which is a ludicrous setup.
And which
I couldn't believe that was the second resort.
Everybody predicted that this would end up being the situation. I mean, I know Weller Evans from way back when I was on the tour 20 years ago, and I've got a lot of time for him. He's hugely experienced, but the view was that his views would be much more closely aligned with those of Justin Gummelstob from the previous situation, and Alex Inglot and both David Igdes obviously were in his camp, and therefore this is a continuation of it. I don't think that Weller Evans is that sort of lame duck personally, but it just doesn't look good and it doesn't feel right. So the thing needs attention pretty urgently, I would suggest.
And he was elected over Nicolas Lapentti.
Yes, meaning there are three English native-speaking people on that player rep board. Which...
And it is for the Americas, isn't it? Mm. It's not just North America, it is the Americas. And Nadal, aside from any, you know, comments on the political leanings of candidates and everything, when the process was just getting underway, he did make the point that it seemed right that there should be a Spanish speaker as a board representative.
Which is a decent argument, certainly an important factor. We'll watch with interest to see what happens next. Final point, Fed Cup has been reformed, and there is going to be a new finals event in April of next year with a qualifying round in February. Catherine, you were there. Billie Jean King was in attendance at the Queen's Club, which I think was the host site of the first ever Fed Cup final.
In 1963, won by the United States, a team of which Billie Jean King was a part. And she was misty-eyed walking around the Queen's Club and looking at the trophy and the whole experience. It's no great surprise that the Fed Cup is being reformed. It's, for me, it's very welcome. I don't know if these reforms are going to be the right answer, but I'm pleased that they're doing them and they're trying them, and I do get the sense that if they do need some, they're open to tweaking after it. This is sort of a first attempt at the right formula, and they're open to tweaking, which for me is important rather than just to say this is the answer, we've come up with a solution to all of the Fed Cup's problems. It's not that. You are going to lose certain things. It is a compromise, but crucially, it retains the home and away ties in the qualifying and playoff matches, and then there's an emphasis on equality and inclusivity with the finals, where the pay, the prize money, will match that of the Davis Cup for players. There'll be a more even distribution of the prize pot in terms of how much goes to federations, how much goes to players themselves. Certainly, I mean, the most prominent message from that press conference was of equality, not just in the prize money itself and how good that is, but the message that sends to the world. You know, they were saying, look, this is a really significant event for women's sport, because tennis is, I mean, might seem to be overtaken by women's football, which is obviously having an incredible moment, but women, tennis is the single most successful sport for women globally, so the women's team event within that sport has a role to play in leadership and the messaging it sends. So,
and they're also putting it on clay, which is a good,
clay
good
in
idea.
Budapest. And I was very impressed, I have to say, with the way the delegation from Budapest talked about Budapest as a host city. I was sort of a little bit prepared to slightly glaze over. You know, man from Budapest says how great Budapest is. You know, you get man from Prague and he'll be telling you how great Prague is. And I'm already sold on Budapest. I've been there for a Champions Tour event and I loved it. But he talked about all the international sporting events that Budapest has hosted in recent years where they haven't had good athlete representation, where Hungary haven't been that well represented, and how good the crowds have been, even to support, you know, random far-flung countries. The crowds have always been there. He talked about the Swimming World Championships. I know they have a couple of prominent swimmers, but even for sessions where there was no Hungarian representation, they've always had really good crowds, and that is crucial. That's one of my concerns about the Davis Cup in Madrid. I think it's one of the ITF's concerns that they're working on trying to remedy. So I was quite convinced by the whole thing. I mean, part of that was spending a morning in the company of Billie Jean King, which would convince me of anything.
But I mean, isn't that in itself, the fact that Billie Jean King is backing it, feels quite significant? I mean, the
yes.
Davis Cup's had a lot of players, ex-players and current players, be really outspoken about it, against it. If Billie Jean King is giving her support, that's a great start. And it for tennis, it feels closer to the right answer than the Davis Cup, just in terms of the position of the calendar, April rather than November, and 12 teams rather than 18, I think, is better for a finals. Like, I'm a bit worried about the Davis Cup. I think I'm looking forward to it, seeing how it goes, but I'm a bit worried that teams could maybe get a bit lost there. Like, how significant is the match going to be on whatever the third court? I think in Budapest it's going to be two match courts, and I think you know there'll be eyeballs on every match, which is what you want. So I think it's a, and it's always felt like the event that needed reform even more, just because of how confusing it all was.
Yeah, absolutely.
I did notice that Simona Halep was quoted as saying she's not going to play it.
Mm.
So it'll be interesting to see whether she sticks to that or not.
And Billie Jean King told her to give it a go for the first one. That does annoy me
to just sort of... Look, it might not be a success. I don't know if it's going to be a success. But it's people not wishing it well that bothers me. People sort of seeming to not want it to be a success or not wanting to support it before it's even had a chance.
Mm.
I do think part of that was a slight reaction to the fact that she personally hadn't been consulted on the changes. So I think that was a factor in her reaction. But yeah, I was a bit disappointed by it.
So that's all happening, as is Wimbledon from tomorrow. 1 o'clock on the two main show courts, 11 o'clock in the morning on the rest of them, so earlier than ever. And it starts with Novak Djokovic opening his title defence on centre court at 1 o'clock on centre.
Against Philipp Kohlschreiber, which is tricky.
Yeah.
He's lost him already this year.
It will be interesting. That's a proper match first up, isn't it? Yulia Putintseva against Naomi Osaka is
also a proper match
after that. Yeah, these are potential upsets, aren't they?
Is Venus against Goff, which I would have put on centre personally.
You would have put that one in place of Carl Edmund against.
I would. Yes.
Jaume Munar.
Yeah, thank you.
You are the only man in town that's getting that right, Matt.
Yeah.
The module of Catalan I did coming in handy.
Simona Halep against Alexandra Sasnovic, first up on court one. Then Jiří Veselý against Alexander Zverev, the newborn Bork. And then it's Venus Williams.
Very definitely be losing first round tomorrow.
Against Coco Gauff. On court number two, starts with Stan Wawrinka against Rubens Bemelmans. Zhu of China, I don't know her first name, sorry, against Karolina Pliskova of the Czech Republic, is second on court two. Then it's Tomas Fabiano. Against Stefanos Tsitsipas. Caroline Wozniacki against Sorribas Tormo. And then we've got, over on court three, Kevin Anderson against Pierre Hugerbert.
And match of the day last on court 18, are we in agreement?
Yeah. Su Weishei against Yelena Ostapenko.
Who's stumbled into some form.
Who's winning that? Quick prediction.
Shay.
Ostapenko. Okay, you've heard it here first on the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, executive produced by TennisBalls.com with our mascot Rio with a Y. If you've enjoyed the last 58 minutes of conversation here on the Tennis Podcast, do tell your friends, tweet about us, share us on social media, just knock random neighbours' doors and in the tent next to you in the queue and just say, have you listened to the Tennis Podcast? We'll get started immediately. Review us on iTunes and we'll be back daily, every single day. We'll be with you for half an hour on the Tennis Podcast at the close of play. See you tomorrow.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.